I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World. Our guests this hour are Neil Ferguson, the historian of the British Empire, advocate in a fashion of an American version, and Amy Chua, the cautionary author of World on Fire. We're talking about globalization in the wake now of a preemptive war in Iraq, in the early stages of what feels like the new American empire. From the other side of empire, the Indian novelist and polemicist Arundhati Roy spoke with us the other day about the world after Iraq. Her new book of essays is titled War Talk. I asked her what she made of Neil Ferguson's call for a neo-imperial America, rather on the British model.
It's a sort of obnoxious call, as far as I'm concerned, you know, and all of us are concerned. To all of us who are people from ex-colonies, what do you expect us to say or think about that? Where are you going to find a person from an ex-colony saying, oh, empire was wonderful for us? It was so lovely that, you know, in 1874, millions of Indians died of drought while food was being exported to England. It was so wonderful, wasn't it?
Well, the Irish remember that, too.
Our languages and civilizations were broken and, you know, apartheid was wonderful in South Africa. Are we going to say that?
You've written about confronting empire. How does the world confront empire, especially when there's no possibility of challenging the U.S. militarily?
Well, when I wrote Confronting Empire, you know, the huge marches against the Iraq war had started, but had not, obviously, the February 15th, you know, massive show of international people's morality somehow had not happened yet. And I think that we, you know, what happened is that empire was forced to go to war stark naked. You know, the halo was toppled. So what we did was, yes, Iraq was crushed, but it was crushed on our terms. It was crushed in, you know, by empire and all its naked brutality. And that is a kind of victory. You know, it's not a victory, but it is a very important thing that happened. Now, I think what is happening in the world is that it is becoming obvious that you cannot confront the American military machine. So what do you confront? You confront the economic outpost of the American empire. And I think you see a lot of that.
You know, what does that mean?
It means that, you know, symbolic resistance, these marches and so on, will become symbolic. So far, they were the substance of the resistance. But now you see real civil disobedience. You know, there are lots of places where now American goods are, you know, being boycotted, and you know that whole thing is going to be real civil disobedience as opposed to the theater of resistance now.
What does the man on the street in India make of all this?
In India, I don't think I've spoken to a single person, and I speak to people from every kind of, you know, rural, urban, every class and caste. Nobody is under any illusions about what's going on, you know, nobody.
But how would they put it? How would they describe what's going on?
They would just describe it as racism in a way, I think, you know, that it is eventually being seen as a racist war, and as imperialism, of course, you know, as an occupation, as an illegal occupation, as bullying, and of course this utterly despicable fact of, you know, even though yes, members of the Security Council voted against the war and so on, but really they colluded to disarm a country and then allow America to attack it. It is, I don't know that there's been such a war ever in the history of the world, you know, where you use diplomacy to make an already poor country disarm. You use sanctions to crush the people, to break the infrastructure, to make sure they have nothing there, and then say they have weapons of mass destruction and attack them. It's an act of cowardice that's hard to hold in the imagination, you know. And people see that. Even before this person who's been convicted for embezzlement, whatever his name is, Chalabi, they're trying to install this democracy. But before they install the democracy, they must make sure that all the tax laws are rewritten, the patent laws are rewritten, the oil fields are secured and privatized. then what is democracy? It doesn't matter because all the main issues have been settled already.
Neil Ferguson, do you want to fire back?
Well, I do, actually. I notice Arundhati Roy using the word obnoxious about my views, but I actually find her views quite obnoxious because it seems to me that all she said amounts to an argument that Saddam Hussein should have been allowed to remain in power. I'm not really sure that regime was doing a terribly large amount for the people who were suffering under it. And, of course, you could say very much the same about a great many post-colonial dictatorships all over the world, which have managed systematically to impoverish their people in addition to disenfranchising them and depriving them of their basic civil and human rights. So it seems to me a little rich for Arundhati Roy, whose country is one of the shining examples of the long-term benefits of British rule, to tell us that it would be better for the Iraqi people if Saddam Hussein was still in power.
But there's a matter of perspective here. I mean, the Indian view is that they made their democracy in opposition to the British Empire. It was no gift from London. They had to fight in a very astute way to get it. But the real question in my mind is not the details of her view, but whether you acknowledge that the depth of that feeling and the breadth of it around the world.
Well, I think one can acknowledge that it's convenient for members of the Indian elite like Arundhati Roy to imagine that they engaged in some great struggle for liberation. But let's not forget that the Indian National Congress was actually founded by Alan Octavian Hume, a former member of the British civil service in India. Let's not forget that it was the British who built 4,400 miles of railway, creating a modern infrastructure
in
India. These sorts of achievements are so easily brushed aside by people like Arundhati Roy, and they, I'm afraid, engage in the falsification of history. I mean, I thought it was pretty typical to have the famine of the 1870s trotted out as if the British had systematically gone about creating that famine, whereas in reality this was a natural disaster, and such disasters had happened throughout Mughal rule as well as under British rule.
Yeah, I think it's
Amy Chua.
Sometimes it's not so helpful to cast about, you know, who's being more racist. One thing, though, it is true that many of the problems that we are facing in the post-colonial world, not just in Iraq but throughout the Middle East, were, to be fair, products of the British Empire. I mean, the British, in many ways, arbitrarily carved, you know, drew lines in the sand, creating nations that made no cultural or historical sense. So it's not all just the post-colonial dictators. I think some of these conditions
I mean, any minute now, I'm going to be told that it was the British who were responsible for the division between Sunni and Shiite Muslims. I mean, come on, the world's ethnic and religious divisions existed long before the British came on the scene. Much of the time, what the British were trying to do was to prevent intercommunal strife, and they were actually pretty successful at that.
I think that the British were.
Whether you look at Mesopotamia or at India.
Interestingly, I actually agree that the British were much more aware than the United States they really understood ethnicity a lot better. In that way, they were able to do some divide and conquer policies and actually were much more educated about it. One thing, though, is I think we can't underestimate the fact that there is just such pervasive hatred and the depth of anti-Americanism today, I think, is really unprecedented in history. And this is something that can't be just pushed aside. I mean, they're obviously, even in countries like the UK that went with us to war, the international public opinion was overwhelmingly against the US going to war. And I think it's important to see that this opposition was closely bound up with fear and hatred of U.S. power and suspicion about U.S. motives. So that's another factor. And going back to the U.S. and Britain, I mean, I actually think that the British did understand ethnicity better. I think it's an embarrassment that the U.S. has been so shocked lately that, that the Shiite majority may be calling for an Islamic state that's anti-American. And this is kind of my point. It's not that I'm against democracy. I'm in favor of it. And markets also. But it's not so easy to install free market democracy in ethnically divided societies. And in particular, in Iraq, where Saddam Hussein's regime was so repressive and brutally unfair and one-sided, it may well be that free market policies would benefit one ethnic group, for example, the Sunnis, whereas democracy might empower, for example, the Shiite majority. And what the democratic outcome might be, or at least majority rule, may be inconsistent with the desires of other ethnic groups. And it also may not be consistent with what the United States has envisioned, in mind for kind of Iraq's oil policy.
Neil Ferguson, do you want a quick word on sort of whether the world will swallow this?
Well, I don't know that the world has a great deal of choice. A far more important question is whether the American electorate will swallow it. I mean, I think it's hilarious to hear Arundhati Roy talk about civil disobedience and campaigns against outposts of American economic power. I just wonder what on earth she has in mind, a demonstrator throwing bricks through the windows of McDonald's, presumably.
No more Coke or something.
Well, this is just ludicrous and farcical, and these people just completely exaggerate the importance of their marching through the streets and their posturing. The real issue...
Wait a minute, now, that's supposed to be important.
Well, I mean, demonstrations are great fun, but they very seldom actually have colossal effects in modern history. Much more important is the question, in my eyes, of whether the American electorate is interested in long-term engagement in countries like Iraq or indeed Afghanistan, which we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, exactly. The example of Afghanistan isn't encouraging to the imperialists, is it?
Well, it's not encouraging. It was always the toughest of all the outposts of British power, the one that
I think,
British found the hardest to control.
Kipling would have urged Bush not to try it, I think.
Well, I think the British recognized that it was important to prevent it coming under Russian influence, and we have seen in our own times how disastrous Russian influence in Afghanistan could be. But the British recognized that this was an almost impossible place to rule directly and ultimately didn't attempt to do so. But I think the key point here is, do Americans remember that they have troops in Afghanistan? Do they recall that there are troops in the Balkans? Is there really any public interest in the long-term fates of these countries? And my impression is that there isn't a great deal of interest, because once the fighting is over and the Marines have done their photo opportunities, then alas, the attention very quickly moves on.
Stand by for callers. The phone's 800-886-9364. Namzi is calling from Chicago.
Yes.
Namzi, welcome.
Thank you. I want to ask for an explanation, please. But before that, I'd like to say that I am in total support of democracy anywhere in the world, because if it is carried out truly, it can be good. But this is my question.
Would you tell us where you were born, Namzi?
I was born in Nigeria.
Nigeria, good.
Yes, and I'm teaching now.
Okay.
I'm a professor at the University of Cincinnati. I teach architecture. But this is my question. How should I understand this experience of Iraq, bearing in mind that in 1850-51, Britain invaded Lagos in order to stop slavery and then occupied the country, or built a country and occupied it. 1830, France invaded Algeria to stop piracy in the Mediterranean Sea. The Belgians took over Zaire later on in 19th century to spread Catholicism under Leopold. Morocco was taken over, and the list goes on. Then the post-colonial elite that was raised, when they steal money, they don't keep it in Africa, they take it to Europe, conspiring with big European bankers and American bankers. Is this any different, this civilizing mission of freedom Iraq, is it any different from the message that Britain passed in going to Lagos, in going France, in Algeria, Belgium?
Excuse me.
That's a good question for Neil Ferguson. Go ahead.
Can I just say at this point, I'm terribly sorry, but there's a lot of interference on this line, and I'm actually hearing some of your producers' exchanges with other callers, and it made it impossible for me to hear the last remarks by the caller. But I heard the first part of...
What he was asking is, is the civilizing mission of the United States in Iraq significantly different from the mission of the British in Africa, or the Belgians in the Congo, for that matter?
Well, I think one has to make a distinction between what happened in the Belgian Congo, in which the Belgian king, Leopold II, essentially ran a slave state in which human life was essentially treated as worthless, and the costs of that in human terms were colossal. Whereas in Nigeria, as your caller rightly points out, and the British presence in West Africa was very much a part of a systematic campaign against the slave trade. Now, of course, the British had their own economic interests and reasons for being in West Africa, but you can't, I think, claim that anything as much anything remotely resembling Belgian rule in the Congo went on in Nigeria. On the contrary, Nigeria essentially prospered under British rule, as did most sub-Saharan African countries who came under British rule. Your caller made the very good point that it's post-independence dictators who've really impoverished most sub-Saharan African countries. In almost every case, I think Botswana is the only exception, per capita income is now lower relative to British per capita income than it was at the end of British rule. So independence has been more or less an unmitigated disaster for almost all these countries.
Neil, what do you make of the fact that callers and people feel, even if assuming, you know, giving you the benefit of the doubt, that there is so much intense feeling about the United States? I agree that because the U.S. is the world's sole superpower, every move we make with respect to Iraq is being closely and perhaps even unfairly scrutinized. So much remains to be seen what we actually do there. And there's a huge burden, and I think it's a great opportunity. But what do you make of the fact that there is so much intensity and perhaps unfair judgment about U.S. actions? And doesn't that worry you about, you know, the U.S. kind of jumping in there and saying, we're the empire? I mean, will it, do you think it, can it take when there's nobody wants it? Or?
Well, my sense is that the extent of anti-Americanism will tend to abate when American interventions are more successful. And the trouble is that only a very few of the sample of American military interventions in the last century have been as successful as those in West Germany and Japan after 1945. I think when you look at all the failures that there have been, the obvious cases that leap to mind would include Haiti or Somalia, it's not too surprising that people take a fairly skeptical view of what American military intervention can achieve. And there's an enormous amount to be said for demonstration effects. Once it's clear, as it was clear by circa 1900, that British rule was generally beneficial for the economies that came under its auspices, then, you know, these things actually become rather less vehement and hostility becomes rather harder to justify. I mean, the fact of the matter is, and this is a point that I think Joseph Nye has made very well, that there's something called soft power out there, that there are many, many things about the American, if you like, way of life or American culture, which are hugely appealing to people. After all, why else are the most talented people in the rest of the world flocking to the United States?
I agree with that.
It can't be anti-Americanism that makes this the most popular destination for
economic
migrants.
But when you talk about economic policies, another thing is that the United States is very, very closely wrapped up in the minds of people in the developing world with the IMF and the World Bank. And throughout Latin America, there is just this very broad-based feeling that on our advice, in our kind of laissez-faire market privatization policies, that these have been disastrous. And there is just huge anti-Americanism there that is, you know, quite separate, although fueled by the actions in Iraq. And so it's not just the Middle East.
It's literally ironic, isn't it? Because, of course, if the World Bank and the IMF didn't exist, these countries would have been far, far worse shape because they wouldn't have had all the bailouts that they've had over the years when their own domestic economic policies went wrong.
Something's not working right in those policies. So it's the caller's turn, though. The phone's 1-800-886-9364. Hitesh is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts.
Good evening, Mr. Leiden.
Welcome, Hitesh.
I just want to say, you know, I read through a couple of weeks ago Neil Ferguson's article, America and Empire in Denial, and he sort of asks us to imagine the world without the British Empire. And he says the mind, I believe the phrase is the mind reels from the counterfactual possibility that you cannot imagine it. And then he goes on to list all the wonderful things that have happened in the world because of the British Empire. Seems to me that's rather having it only one way, if I might turn that around. If you take credit for all the good things, surely you've got to take some of the credit or the blame for some of the bad things. And some of them have been pretty awful. You know, Mr. Ferguson has a list of the benefits of the British Empire, chief among them the English language. And there were, of course, languages before the English language was exported, kind as it was of the English to bring it out. He lists things, for example, like banking law or land laws. And one wonders, for example, what the millions of Indians who starved to death in the reformation of banking and land ownership laws in India, think of the benefits of the British Empire. In this respect, it might be useful to think of the Indian thinker Ashish Nandi, who points out that, in fact, without the imperial age, it is not possible to imagine either the First or the Second World Wars.
Hitesh, it's Neil Ferguson's turn.
Well, I think the important point is to make a clear distinction here between my arguments about the British Empire's contribution to modernity and the sort of moral judgments that are very often made. My book doesn't argue that everything about the British Empire was good, that it was good in the sense of morally good, because quite clearly, from a completely absolute philosophical standpoint, it's not good for one country, a few islands off the northwest coast of Europe, to rule over 350 or 400 million Indians. So I think we have to be very careful here not to get into moral arguments that I don't make. What I say is that the economic benefits of British rule in creating the world's first authentically globalized integrated economy were measurable, and they're better than the alternatives would have been. I mean, after all, nobody, I think, could claim that Mughal rule, had it been continued or had it been restored in 1857, would have been economically better for India than British rule. The key thing is to ask what the viable, plausible historical alternatives were. And of course, your caller, Hitesh, mentions the Second World War. It's a very good example, because the alternatives to British rule in 1939-40 were not independence for India, but Japanese rule for the whole of Asia, or German rule for the whole of Eurasia and Western Europe. Now, those were the alternatives, the real existing alternatives, and if the British Empire hadn't existed in 1940, those powers would have won.
Imichua, I want to ask you, there will not be a military war against the American Empire, but where should we look for sort of organized, significant backlash beyond demonstrations from the rest of the world? And why don't we feel more of it already?
Well, I've talked about different kinds of anti-Americanism, because it's important to realize that this is not a monolithic phenomenon. So I think, in my view, the entire European Union is, in many sense, a reaction in an attempt to counter U.S. Sole superpower status. And even the proposal of the euro currency is an attempt to kind of battle the U.S. And then there's other countries. You know, we may see alliances. So who knows what will happen with China and Russia. But I think that the most important part is that with the America's unprecedented power right now, there are so many avenues have been closed off. I mean, in my field, people are, you know, we talked about the rule of law. And so one thing that really can't happen so much anymore is the confiscation or nationalization of American property, or, you know, because we can essentially level sanctions or do such impose such heavy economic costs in other countries that those outlets are also closed off. And I think what's frightening is that because of our power and because so many other outlets that might not be desirable have been closed off, in some ways, what you see instead is violence and terrorism. I mean, these are the outlets now by very hopeless, frustrated, angry people. You know, Neil may be right about the actual benefits here and there. I'm not really in such disagreement, but I guess I'm so much more concerned about the perception, because I think that this matters. I think how people perceive us matters. And for that reason, I agree with him that, you know, I'd prefer to see this as an opportunity going forward. You know, so much depends on what the U.S. does right now. We can't afford to do anything that smacks of hypocrisy or glaring self-interest in Iraq. He said that, you know, one of the myths has to do with the oil companies. I hope he's right. But I think that one thing we have to do is, going forward, the United States has to make sure that whatever new regime comes in, if we can even kind of handle it, has to, unlike Saddam Hussein's regime, include the Iraqi people themselves in the benefit of Iraq's oil wealth.
Of course. Imichua, stand by. Neil Ferguson, the phone is 800-886-9364. We're talking about the future of globalization, or has Americanization swallowed it up? We'll be back. This is The Whole Wide World, coming to you from the studios of WGBH Boston, distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World with Neil Ferguson, whose new book is called Empire, and Amy Chua, whose book is World on Fire. We're talking about the future of globalization. Can I take it a little bit out of the political or the military, Neil Ferguson? The story of our time, really, at the end of the 20th century, has been the liberation, culturally speaking, of post-colonial voices. I mean, it is literally the Salman Rushdie era, in a way, when you look at all the Nobel Prize winners from the Caribbean, from Africa. So many colonial peoples have learned to speak in a world language. At the same time, we're in the Internet, World Wide Web era, in which the whole world can talk to each other in a very democratic and open fashion. I just wonder, what's your take on the global future, culturally speaking? Can it ever be bottled up or controlled in a way that the British controlled the 19th century?
Well, I suppose I should preface my answer by saying that Irish and Indian writers were winning Nobel Prizes and producing great literature under British rule as well as under independent governments. So let's not imagine that Salman Rushdie invented the great works of Indian fiction. So I think it's quite important not to pretend that decolonization has had a great literary payoff. The literary payoff was, in fact, the anglicization of these cultures and the creation of a lingua franca, of a common language that really the world increasingly can share. No, I think the point you make about the cultural integration of the world brought about by electronic communications is an important one, although it's not as if it's something completely new. 100 years ago, the world had been integrated as never before by a different technology, the telegraph, to say nothing of the steamship and railway. And the Victorians presided over the first age of global communication. And in many ways,
they were not as democratic or as open or as cheap as Internet email is.
Right, of course. And that's precisely the qualitative difference that one has to identify here. Now, are you asking me, does this make the world a different place? Yes. Does it make it harder to run a global empire in all but name? I'm not sure that it does, really. I mean, it seems to me, for example, that one of the great benefits of the Internet, most obvious to me, is that it's making it much harder for the most powerful dictatorial regime in the world, namely that of the People's Republic of China, to monopolize information.
I had
a really interesting conversation recently with some Chinese journalists, and I said, "Well, what was the big event of your youth, the turning point?" And they said, "Well, it wasn't Tiananmen Square; it was being able to read the New York Times on the net, because from then on, it was really impossible for the government to monopolize information."
I think the internet
really helps to spread American culture. It makes it very much more attractive when you can actually log on and read it and realize what freedom of information means.
I think that part is certainly true. I think what we're going to see on the internet going forward is really just explosions of the love-hate relationship with U.S. culture. And I doubt that you would disagree with this. Yes, there's definitely, the internet has helped facilitate lots of U.S. culture, U.S. values, human rights, capitalism. On the other hand, what we have definitely seen, certainly with 9/11, is that the internet facilitates also the spread of illiberal ideologies. I mean, fundamentalism, Islam, this has also utilized the internet. And similarly, ethnic nationalism and indigenous movements, kind of these illiberal ideas that are sort of non-Western, are also, these pass through the internet also. So I think you're going to see backlash and embrace at the same time.
Stand by for calls. 800-886-9364. Dahi is calling from Toronto.
Good evening.
We think of Toronto as kind of the global center of literary power and now of mobile disease.
Well, I will reassure your listeners and your guests that SARS is not transmitted through telephones before I ask my question. Basically, the idea of democracy and rule of law being established. Now, by most measures, Canada will be seen as a democracy in the Western tradition. Yet, the vision, for example, of multiculturalism in a city like Toronto is very different to that of New York. The idea of capitalism and the Canadian welfare state differs from the American model. The concept of rights, whether individual or collective, and even the accommodation between English speakers and French speakers. I would wonder, and I'd put this to Neil Ferguson, that perhaps this version of democracy, something that's more rooted in multilateralism and multiculturalism, is more likely to be accepted on a global level. And the same thing would apply with the European Union, where they've had to struggle with civil law, with common law, and there's all these other, there's more than one democracy, there's more than one way to define rule of law. And maybe the jerk reaction of anti-Americanism, because people don't like, it's not that they don't like democracy, it's they don't like the American capitalist version of democracy.
Do you think the world should be playing Canadian hockey and living the Canadian way, Dahi? Is that the idea? Is that the seat of empire?
I wouldn't say it's a seat of empire, but certainly the idea that Jim Moore talks about of a second superpower, of there being something other than purely an American hegemony. I personally think that the culture of somewhere like Toronto it works its way into Canadian foreign policy. That a city that has such a version of tolerance and of a mosaic rather than a melting pot, as the cliche goes, is always going to value the institutions of the United Nations and of cooperation rather than of power and unilateralism.
I agree with the caller very much. I'm all in favor of promoting both markets and democracy globally, but I think that we have, in fact, been exporting the wrong version. In fact, I think we've been promoting a caricature of free market democracy. You know, it's not just multicultural. You know, there's no Western nation today with anything close to a laissez-faire system, but that's what the United States has essentially been doing for the last 20 years, urging poor countries around the world to adopt a kind of bare-knuckled brand of capitalism that the West abandoned a long time ago. And I think this is one of the sources of anti-Americanism. And I think that's, and I more controversially, I think it's the same with democracy. I think for the United States, democracy has just been, you know, when it's convenient, telling poor countries of the world to just implement immediate elections with universal suffrage. And democracy, I think, in the West is much more than just unrestrained majority rule. And a lot more is needed than just shipping out ballot boxes for elections, which we encouraged and which brought people like Slobodan Milosevic to power.
Well, I can't resist pointing out at this point that if Canadian institutions are preferable to those of the United States, it might have something to do with the fact that Canada remained part of the British Empire for rather longer than the United States. And that's actually a serious
point. All those loyalists.
Because the institutions in Canada do much more closely resemble the institutions that are characteristic of British democracy. And there's no doubt, as your caller, distinctly an Irishman by the sound of his accent, as your caller says, that in many ways these are more appealing than the American model, which doesn't necessarily export that well unless it's quite heavily modified. I think the key here is the point you made, Christopher, about perception. I think it's tremendously important that the United States should not be seen to be acting unilaterally. And one of the biggest mistakes that President Bush made in adopting his, even before 9/11, self-consciously unilateralist approach to diplomacy is that he allowed his critics abroad to caricature him and to caricature the United States, whereas actually previous regimes, including Bill Clinton's, had been much more successful at acting pretty much in America's unilateral interest, but doing it through international or supranational agencies. I mean, nobody complained when Bill Clinton launched airstrikes against Serbia, despite the fact that there was absolutely no UN resolution. He didn't even bother taking it to the UN, and he acted on the basis of what was, in effect, an Anglo-American decision to use force to kick Slobodan Milosevic out of what was Serbian territory, Kosovo. It's all about presentation, and if this administration were a little less fond of winding people up, to put it very crudely, and recognize that there are real payoffs to playing or using the language of internationalism, I think they would get much more of what they actually want.
But, you know, it's not just perception, Neil, it seems to me, in the way of salesmanship. There's a deeper reality of whether, or question in my mind, whether the Americans have patience for a kinder, gentler, slower built, deeper rooted, more complexly ethnic democracy of the sort that Iraq is going to need.
Well, of course, they've been running a multi-ethnic democracy in the United States for long enough. It's not as if problems of ethnic difference are unknown to American politicians. If you go back 100 years, you could practically understand American politics only with an ethnic map.
I think that's true, but the ethnic structures of the non-Western world are so completely different from those in the contemporary Western nations. I mean, we, of course, have lots of ethnic diversity, but our main problem is a kind of politically and economically dominant white majority, in quotes, and, you know, all kinds of economically and politically more oppressed minorities. Now, other countries have very different dynamics. Again, going back to Iraq, I'm not sure what the Bush administration has in mind for the 60% Shiite majority that may, majority rule there may be quite inconsistent with what the U.S. has in mind for its own, you know, market policy, for example.
This is fun, but we'll have to do it again. Thank you, Amy Chua. Thank you, Neil Ferguson. Amy Chua's book is World on Fire. Neil Ferguson's is Empire. Thanks also to Arundhati Roy, author most recently of a book of essays called War Talk. The Whole Wide World is a collaboration of Leiden and McGrath Productions and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. We had help from producers Ben Walker and Catherine Bidwell, engineers Tom Tiger and Ray Fallon, also from Amy McDonald, Josh Ward, Keith Kyle Wilson, Justin Grotlucian, Jake Shapiro, Miles Smith, and Tom Devlin. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Leiden.
PRI, Public Radio International.